I'm totally excited and so happy that I can welcome today Thomas Moore to the Conscious Evolution Summit. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you, Priya. I'm very happy to be with you.
Yeah, Thomas, I mean, with you, we will talk about one of my favorite subjects of the ageless soul. I mean, you wrote, I guess, 25 books or more about this topic and about spirit and about becoming more conscious of this, you could say, this dimension, this realm in us as a human being. And so I'm really looking forward to our conversation, Thomas.
Yes, I love to talk about this subject. I've written so much, but every book I try to write on a different angle of the same subject.
Yes. Yeah. And I just wonder, Thomas, because I had an encounter with my ageless soul when I was about 17. So there I became really conscious about it. And I just wonder, how was it for you? When did it happen? How did you experience it? Just to take us a bit into your universe, what kind of happened that you became so curious about it?
It's really hard to say. I have to start at the beginning. I grew up in a very devout Catholic, Roman Catholic family. And very early on, when I was 13, I joined a monastery. I left home to be part of mostly monastic life. And I stayed there for 13 years. Was a very intense, all that time was very intense spiritual life and community life. In my language, I would say it was full of spirit and soul. It was very spiritual, a lot of meditating and ritual, especially, and study. So all those were considered the life of the monk. Study was part of it. It was a spiritual practice. And I still do that. I still study. Maybe you can see I still have my books around me. And I love living this way to keep that there. So I think I first encountered the idea of soul and not being stuck just in time. I think I definitely encountered that living the monastic life. And when I left it, I didn't leave it all entirely. I have tried to maintain that lifestyle and working around those themes. So there isn't a huge difference between my life way back then, I mean, decades ago, and now.
And what would you say is kind of, in your experience, necessary that in a way, in a life where you are not in a monastery, where you are really in life, to keep this spirit and this alive?
That's a wonderful question. I think about it all the time. So part of it is that we have reached the point, my family and I have reached the point where we are living very much in the natural world. We are in the woods and we live right on a lake. And so we are very much around. Animal life is all around us. And sometimes when we go out for a walk, we make sure we have someone with us because there are bears around us. And, you know, that kind of a life, the natural world maintains a spiritual life in a way. And family life maintains a life of soul. There's always something to deal with in family life. And there are the joys of being together, and knowing each other well and doing things we'd like to do and having that intimacy. So I think that to me is the most important thing, making certain lifestyle choices, not just for practical purposes, but to take care of both your soul and your spirit.
Wow, I so much resonate with that, Thomas. I mean, this is kind of also what happened in my life. So I now also live just next to a forest. No bears around, but really a lot of nature, not so many people, not so much traffic. And it's not that I want to judge living in a city, but just as you mentioned, for me, it supports me in really kind of being really intimate with inner dimension where I'm not so easily distracted. And I sense, as you said, that nature really holds a certain frequency where it's so easy to find it also in myself. So yeah, so I'm really grateful that you mentioned that, because in a way we would maybe overlook it, because we would maybe look for methods and practices and teachings, right. But often it starts really with the simple things just in front of us.
Well, you know, that is a very essential part of my philosophy. It is to, my most important idea is to keep the soul and spirit and the world, the ordinary life together. I don't want to ever separate the ordinary from the spiritual and the soulful. So that means that I'm not so interested in any spiritual formality anymore. I don't, I'm not interested too much in what goes on in spiritual communities and in churches for myself. You know, I know other people, it means a lot, but for me, it doesn't. It's the same with city and nature. I don't want to split those. In my life, I've lived in cities and really loved living in cities. And I love to go to big cities now. I really enjoy. I try to get to London as much as I can, and to New York and places like that. But so it's not about choosing one over the other altogether, absolutely. But there are times in life maybe to go in one direction and other times go in another direction. So you can find the soul in all these places. But I think the variety and following your deep inner inclinations is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. And Thomas, in your experience, what would you say, what opens up or opened up and still opens up from moment to moment, I guess, by being really deeply rooted in that and really embodying it, as you said, through just all facets of life? What offers you that? Or offers is not a really a good word, but how is life different kind of when you really come from this place in us?
Well, there are many things to say. One is that you don't control as much as in maybe a more ego-centered life, a more modern life. I think modern people really like to control life more, to make the proper decisions all the time. I don't worry about that. I follow my inclinations. I follow an inner guidance. And if I make a mistake in interpreting that, well, I'll adjust and do something else. So that's one thing. I think we have to surrender some control and read the signs. That's something I always talk about, is to read the signs. So if there's an indication it's time to change, then you ought to take that seriously. Read those signs. You can't act on them spontaneously all the time, because you might be wrong that way. You may not quite understand what is being said in the way life is presenting itself to you. The example that is very strong for me is when I left the monastery, monastic life. That was a beautiful life. I didn't have any good reason to leave, but I felt a change in myself, and I felt that there was an inner move to, it was quite clear to me that I had to make a change from inside, but I couldn't come up with a good reason. And I think that's what we always look for, are the reasons. So I didn't do that because I had a good reason. I changed because I felt that there was a shift, and that like, oh, it's, I mean, I have to be careful what I say. It's almost like hearing a voice saying that, you know, it's time to move on. I mean an inner voice. I don't mean anything too, you know, too weird. Just a sense that it's time to move. And I think if you can live in a way that you pay attention to those inner voices and intelligently trust them. I don't mean trust them naively, but intelligently. Mm. Think things through, talk things over, and then make a decision. I think that's the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm. And what just comes to my mind when I listen to you, Thomas, is that sometimes I had it when my outer life and my inner life wouldn't really match. It would really feel kind of painful. I could really feel a certain pain where I would see something isn't in alignment. Something isn't really how I behave or what I do isn't really in alignment. And then it gets painful. And often, as you said, on a rational level, you wouldn't find reasons so easily or answers, but there is this inner knowing that something needs to be adjusted. How would you recognize it?
It's very hard to say. I think one of the most important things is to develop a habit of reading your life, reading the signs of what's happening. You can't just do it once and feel comfortable. But if you have a habit of doing that, then you know how to do that kind of, how to live that life that way. When you were mentioning, describing that, I had several thoughts, different ways in which you can move in life. And one that you were mentioning is if you have some pain or some disturbance or things aren't working right, that's a clear way to move. And I think the sting of life and some things not working out, it's a good thing to read and make a change. But if I keep saying that, people think that I'm too negative. I'm always saying, follow your pain. I don't mean that. That's one of many things. Another thing you can do is follow your desire. So if you have a strong desire to do something, you have to sort out your desire, but you can, again, intelligently reflect on your desires and see what your deep desire is. In the psychological world that I spent a long time in, we used to say, you ask the question, what does your soul want? Not what you want, because that's a little too surface and you can't really trust that. But what does your soul want? It's a deeper question. Deep down, what desire is there? And to follow it, pay attention to it. Another way is to follow your dreams. And so by that I mean night dreams. Pay attention to your night dreams because there's a great deal of guidance in night dreams. So in my work as a therapist, I'd say I spend about probably 80% of the time and attention on night dreams to get a sense of what is happening at that level, as though that were a very direct expression of soul. So in my work, I can't imagine not working without paying attention to the night dreams. And then occasionally what we do in our family is we use some magic. I use an obsidian stone when it comes to making a decision. It helps us reflect on which way to go. Like having a sense, I think what we need today, a lot of that we don't have and people used to have, is a sense of prophecy. A way of foretelling the future. And it sounds a little far out maybe, but what I mean is just a very natural power, strength that you might have to be able to think about the future and to make some good decisions about the future. And out of a sense of, and maybe it's a kind of intuition, that sense of prophecy, foretelling.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, how I used to do it is that in a way I feel that a part of me already is in the future and I kind of connect to a part of me, which is this time way ahead, and and get kind of insights from there. Often it's not very detailed. It's more abstract and not so rational, sometimes with images or feelings, but this I use as kind of a compass, a guideline. And I just wonder how you experience it, Thomas.
Well, yes, I think what you're saying is really important. You can't, when you enter the realm of the imagination, which means intuition and all these other things, dreams and everything, when you enter that realm, you don't have the same precision you have when you are, your eyes are wide awake. But when you're awake, you don't have the same deep intuition. So there are disadvantages and advantages to both things. So you can't expect when you're following your intuition and imagination for everything to be crystal clear and to have make logical sense. Logic is not really at work at that level. It's a different thing. So you have to trust more. There's a kind of trust you develop. My friend Hillman wrote a wonderful essay once on trust. It was called Betrayal, his essay. But he wrote about trust. And one of the things he said was that as you get older, you have to switch from being naively trusting. So you just think, okay, I'm just going to trust what's coming up and follow it. That's a bit naive. To being more sophisticated in your trust so that you can trust and you follow trust, but you have your eyes open in a sense. Your inner eyes are open. Your mind is at work. Your intelligence is in play. So that when you are trusting, you are also thinking a lot about what you're doing. So you don't just say, okay, I trust whatever. You can't live that way. But I think you can do it in a way that is intelligent.
Is it then only a matter of practice, or do you have some advices how one could develop that?
Yeah, it's not just practice helps. Yeah, that's what I was saying before. If you keep doing this enough, you get better at it. You really do, because you understand better how it works. I feel that way as a therapist too, that I'm in my own life, I do live by trust a great deal and intuition. And so when I'm talking to somebody else, I know that realm. You know, I know it because I do it. It's when you do something, you get to learn more about it. It's subtleties, and you get your technique is better. There are many ways, I think, in which you can also develop that attention to your imagined life. And one of the things that I do, a lot of people, I don't think people appreciate it as much these days, is that I study a great deal. And getting back to that theme, I read a lot. I study. I love study. And as I said, when I was a young man, I was taught that to study is a spiritual practice. And books and libraries and research and now research online, all of that is part of a spiritual life. And so I see it as a very meaningful thing to do. And because then my imagination is full of all of these different resources, then when it comes to trusting and following intuition, I can rely on a lot that I've learned about it from other people. I don't read as an academic, like a university person might. What I do is I study more to be able to live what I'm learning. So I study people like Carl Jung, who himself in his life explored these different avenues, different ways of living. So I learn from him and his experience. It's not just an intellectual mind thing. It's learning from some other person who devoted his life to these various issues we're talking about. I might think of, I also read W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, who also lived this way and wrote about it, was very interested in that kind of living. There are some other psychologists, James Selman, I mentioned, also Rollo May, who was an excellent psychologist, who talked about living in this form. And so I study these people who were not just writing off the top of their heads. They were writing about their deep experiences, and I trust them.
Mm-hmm. So it's when I listen to you, what really I come aware of is that it's really then talking and acting from this knowing and not talking about it, or it's really then inside and it kind of, yeah, moves
right
out from your experience.
Yeah, there is a kind of intellectualizing that is, as Jung said, Freud said, it's a defense. It's a defense. It's a way of defending against life. So you intellectualize everything and then you don't have to live. But that's not what I'm talking about. I think there's a way to have an intellectual life. I would say using your mind with soul, you know, a soulful intellectual life. Mm-hmm. So that means that it's directly related to life, and also the way I presented these other writers, I think it's really important to think of them in a certain way, that they are not just people giving you ideas. They are human beings who have lived what you are trying to live. And they did their best, as I do, to express that experience in words. And it takes a great deal. I know it takes a lot of work to put all that into words. And so I think I can take up someone like my friend James Selman and continue to read him, and I know that he lived what he's talking about.
And Thomas, in your experience, what role plays relaxation and openness? Because I sense this is our crucial qualities to kind of live in a open, relaxed kind of way.
The people that I know that I trust most had a great sense of humor. They could see humor in everything. And I know the time that I spent with Hillman, he and I spent a lot of private time together. We were always laughing, not at silly things, but usually, but always laughing at the absurdity of life, or, you know, things like that. It was a loving life, but being able to see life as a comedy rather than a tragedy. And that's part of it. Mm-hmm. So I think if you go in a good direction with all of your study and your experience, then what you do is you end up in a way of life that is relaxed. You're not full of anxiety because you've explored all these things and you find some confidence. I find a great deal of confidence in my study. And I need other things. I need more experience and various things. I need to develop my own character. That's part of it. But I have to go through difficult times too. I think all of us go through difficult experiences, and that's really part of it. We learn a great deal from the trials that come along. So put all that together, and I think if you are close to life and you haven't defended against it, but have really allowed life to happen for you, you can relax better.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, just sitting with you together and being in your presence, I really feel such a strong quality of peace you just embodied, this. Yeah, being really in peace and yet really kind of very vital and awake, but still very peaceful. This is what I immediately got when I saw you the first time. And I just think that our world could have a bit more of that in each one of us.
Yes, we're too serious, really. We're too serious. I think sometimes of my namesake, Thomas More, the saint from England, who lived in the 16th century. And I've had him as a model for much of my life. And he was he was full of humor. He died, you know, he died having being decapitated by the king, who was his friend. But he had a sense of humor even in prison before he was executed. Right up to the end, he was playing on words and joking with everyone, people around him and his family. And he cultivated with his family, he had four children, he cultivated with his family a strong sense of humor, but a sharp one. Not an ugly one, not where you are making fun of other people or that your laughter is at the expense of someone. That's not it at all. But to appreciate the depths of life so much that you break out into laughter because the whole thing does have a certain comic quality. And I think that the best spiritual teachers have that too. Like many of the Zen teachers and Sufi teachers have such a good sense of humor. And that really helps to get through all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in a way, what I also sense is that when I'm really in tune with this ageless part in myself, I feel not so dependent on the circumstances, although I experience all of it, but the way how I am isn't so much dependent on what's happening there.
That's right. It isn't as important as it looks. This is clearer to me the older I get, that what really counts is so much what is happening, not just inside you, but inside the world itself that you live in. There's an interiority of the world. I think that's an important concept too, so that we don't make it all about ourselves and all our own interior life. But that there's an interiority of the world outside of us. It has meaning and it has incredible value. We're having trouble with that these days because there's so much narcissism in the world. That may be the most common and most dangerous disorder we have. Psychological disorder is narcissism. It's an irrational concern and worry about being somebody, of having value. That's what it is. And it shows itself then symptomatically as an exaggerated attention to yourself. It's like you have to do it because you don't feel the world is giving you the attention. And therefore, people get all absorbed in their own private, personalistic worlds. And don't worry about the planet, which is suffering tremendously. And don't worry that we're losing so many species of animals. I mean, that's such a sad thing to think about. And frightening to think about losing our world if it's being sick and not seeing it as an issue we really have to deal with. That, I think, essentially comes from narcissism, from a worry about yourself. And so this, what we're talking about, being relaxed and being comfortable and confident with yourself, is so important. I think it's very important to be able to express your creativity in whatever way you are drawn. And if people can't do that, they end up with some psychological problems, serious problems. And one of those is narcissism. So psyche and spirit go together all the time. You can't really separate them.
I'm really happy that you mentioned that, and also this this aspect of how important it is to really express our creativity and to not kind of maybe not be too much fixated on any outcomes. Or often people just think of with everything needs to make money or needs to be of value, and but this playful way of just expressing. Maybe you want to kind of talk a bit more about that.
Yes, the arts are in themselves are one way of expressing this creativity, and they are so important to us. They're important in many ways. For one thing, the arts are are sort of placed midway between the utter absolute depth of our world and who we are and our surface life. So we can listen to music and maybe look at the visual arts of some gifted painters and sculptors and architects, dancers. And we can, in that way then, be in tune with, always in tune with this deeper, less literal world that we live in. And then find our own ways to be creative. We have our own outlets or ways of being creative, and they vary so much from one person to another. Some people really love to create music or to paint. Mm-hmm. And other people like to garden, or I know people who find their creativity best expressed in doing accounting with numbers and finance. Not my way, but I know people who really enjoy that, and that's their creative outlet. Mm-hmm. There are many ways. My father was a plumber, and he would come home from work sometimes. He taught plumbing. And he would come home from work, and he would just go on and on of what a beautiful plumbing job he saw that day. Wonderful pipes and welding. And he was ecstatic about it, because to him that was a way to be creative, to resolve those issues of getting water from one place to another effectively. So there are many ways we can be creative. Mm. But there's a difference between working and living in a sort of drudgery fashion where you suffer it and you don't really enjoy it and you don't feel that you are exercising your creativity. And another way to do almost anything that is more that is more creative. So I think we really need to move in that direction. It's essential, because if you don't, you get depressed. I think depression comes from the loss of the creative spirit.
Mm. Yeah, and what just came to my mind while I listened to you, Thomas, was I had a period in my life where I would just start painting, and I haven't painted since my childhood, so it was more than 35 years or 30 years in between. And what was so incredible to experience was that, as I wouldn't say I am a painter or I'm good in painting, I really stood back and was there with curiosity, with this attitude, what wants to be painted on this piece of white canvas in front of me. I took my ego and puria totally out of the way, and I just afterwards I experienced that this year, 3 or 4 years of really extensive painting, just was a kind of meditation to let something move through me, which where I, my mind and my personality wasn't in the way. So is it what you mean by really being creative and expressing that?
Yes, I think so. I can add to that. Something I'm very interested in is what some people would call a muse. Muse, like a something within us that inspires our creativity. For me, when I sit down to write a book and I'm working on it, it takes many, many, many days, months of writing. So it's not a quick thing. It's not a quick job. And some days I sit down to write and that muse is not present. Some days it is. I get phrases come out that I could never come up with myself. It's just words come out, and they're smooth and poetic. But if I sit down and try to write that way, just from my normal waking sense, I can't do it. So I need a relationship to what it is that really does do the creative work. It's not really myself. It's not an ego kind of thing. It's something else. I think it's a dialogue. This is what, again, W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, said. it's a dialogue between what he called his other self or his antithetical self and him. He said it's out of the dialogue that you get a creative work. Mm-hmm. And that's, I can understand that, because I do have to work very hard to make sure the book is done correctly and that the ideas are proper and all that. And I do a lot of research as I work. But at the same time, I need this other presence. It's like a creative, I mean, I would use the word, and I know it can be misunderstood, I use the word angel for it. Mm. There's an angelic, I think angels are very real. Not physically real, but real in another realm altogether. So I know that there's a presence that will give me creative ideas and words even.
Mm-hmm.
And that's real. And I like the traditional word for that. The angel who comes and gives you the words you need,
mm-hmm.
is the go-between some original source of life and yourself. The angels have wings because they keep traveling back and forth, these two realms. I like that idea very much, that moving between heaven and earth, to speak poetically about it.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah. I relate so much to it, Thomas, because what I just expressed before is that I also would kind of, when I was in this painting process, I had the feeling it's such an intimate love affair happening with what you would call an angel. And sometimes I would just cry because I was so touched and of this really being so intimate with such an presence, which is hard to put in words. And yeah.
So what's so interesting is that when you have that experience, at least as I have it, then I need to bring my normal earthly intelligence into play so that what I write is not too far out. Because I find sometimes that what the angel gives me is way too much. It's excessive. It wouldn't work as a book. So what I had to do is then get my quieter self at work, my intelligent self, and together, you know, the two of us, we work this thing out so that it isn't excessive as inspiration, and it's not excessive as just hard intellectual work. It's a mixture of the two. It's a dialogue between the two.
Mm-hmm. So, Thomas, would you say that kind of the source of creativity and being in contact with our ageless soul is the same direction?
The same thing. It's being creative about life. Yeah, it's the same idea. So this we can learn from someone like Socrates, the Greek, who said that he always followed what his word for angel was, daimon. That was the Greeks. The Greeks called the angel the daimon. And he said that his daimon would tell him especially what not to do. It didn't tell him too much of what he should do, but it did tell him what not to do. It would warn him. And a lot of times it was about love, he said. He said his daimon was primarily about love. So your love of something, you know, your love of the work or love of a place or love of a person, whatever it is, that comes from someplace. You know, you don't manufacture that. But you do have to work it out in life. So again, your creative self is the combination of the source of inspiration, the angel or daimon. And the other side is being an intelligent person who can sort all that out and give it a place in this world that makes sense.
I really like how you beautifully really bring these two parts together in a kind of, it's like, feels like a marriage of these two parts.
Yes, it is very much like that. Now, in order to have this life, though, I think you have to cultivate it. So you have to prepare yourself and your circumstances, your life. You have to arrange it in such a way that you can be inspired. It's not going to happen automatically. If you're the kind of person who's always having to do everything logically, and purposely, like you were saying before, if everything has to be about making money and about getting yourself ahead, advancing your ego, then you are not going to be terribly open, maybe not open enough to listen to the guidance that comes from outside of that. And so you have to create a lifestyle. I think that's why many artists have an unusual lifestyle. They do something that allows them to be more open to the presence of the Dhamma or angel. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a serious business. That's a very serious thing to do, to create the lifestyle that is required. It's not just trying to make life work out. So you decide where to live and what your home is going to be like and what your room, your studio or whatever room you work in is going to be like, what your schedule is, what kind of friends you have around you. All of that can foster this relationship between you and your muse. Mm-hmm. But if you don't give it something, if you don't give some attention to that, then it's going to be more difficult to live through from inspiration. And I find that a lot of people are frustrated as artists, or frustrated in their life generally, because they don't understand why they can't get moving, why it doesn't happen. And you need both sides of this cooperation in order for it to work. You need both the inspiration and the hard work and the study. So if you can do it all, it'll work out fine. It's not such a huge project, but our modern life, this is a big issue for us. Our modern world doesn't understand these things. We talked about an angel like I'm talking about it, or a muse. I think most modern people would think I was really, needing some medication. So we have to be, I think what I always say is we have to step outside the modern world to some extent. You can't have this ageless life and live in the modern world, because modern means, the word itself, modern means of the day. It's the opposite of timeless, or it's the opposite. So we have to step outside. That means you have to decide not to participate, at least to some extent. That's essential. Mm-hmm.
And Thomas, what would you say, what is especially of important in when we come to an age where we're really, maybe over 60, over 65, where many of the people really realize, now I come into a phase where I kind of have the last chance to really find out how to live my life well, what I want to dedicate my time and my attention. And just maybe you can share a bit, especially when we come into this phase of our life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, when we get older, a little bit older, we have opportunities. There are problems to deal with, but I think they're generally exaggerated. There are many opportunities when you get older. One hopes that you have learned some things, that you have solved some of these problems that you and I have been talking about. I think that when you get older, you can do them better, because there's so much heroism in the early part of life. So much of a need to succeed and to become somebody and to find the love you want and get yourself established financially. All of that is such a heroic activity. When you get older, one hopes, if the world works out well, you can relax in some of those things, and you still have to make a living. I understand that very well. But you can relax more because you aren't pushing so hard to become somebody. You can relax and give your attention to things that you couldn't give yourself to before. You could paint more. You could write more. You could spend more time with your friends. You could go out into nature more. You could meditate more. You could by meditating, for me, meditating means, these days, means more like playing the piano, which is what I do. Music is part of, is my meditation. Or contemplation is a word I prefer. So contemplating in nature, or contemplating in an art gallery, art museum. There's so many other ways to contemplate, just listening to some good music. Mm-hmm. All of those contemplative things, you can do them better, I think, when you get older. So I would hope that this is an opportunity to shift. You have to imagine it that way. If you see it only as a negative, you're not going to do it. You have to see it having positive things to offer and adjust to it. And be an older person as you get older. I'm 78 now. I think I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And I just, when I tune into this topic, I just sense kind of a bit of a pain, because my impression is that on a society level, it feels like as if there is some potential in this age of people which we are not really able right now to kind of keep it alive and to participate, or to find ways how it can really participate in our society. It's a bit difficult to express for me, but maybe you get what I mean.
I think I'm not positive, but I think so. So yes, I think that as you get older, another aspect of it, and I wrote about this in my book on aging, Ageless Soul, that you can give, you have something to offer to the world. Today people sometimes call that being an elder. Not a word that I use easily. I don't know. It doesn't work too well for me, but I understand people use that word, to be an elder. What it means is that as you get older, that you realize you have something to teach younger people. I think as you get older, actually any time of your life, it's extremely important not to split, enter into the typical and easy divisions that happen in life. One of them would be between men and women, male and female. I think we have to be in gray areas more than on the extreme in that regard. And also in youth and age, it's a good idea not to be on the extreme anytime, or to say or do anything that separates these two. So as you are getting older, it's very important to keep your youth, not to let it go. Not in an exaggerated way, not desperately, but comfortably, to keep your youthfulness. And you can do that by being around younger people as you get older. You can do it by watching your tongue, that you don't say negative things about young people. Because that is not something, that's something that's deep. It's almost like mythic, archetypal, and older people to be negative about young people. You got to watch out for that, because what that does, it splits you. It divides the youth and age within yourself. That's not a good thing. And as you get older, then, being an elder, to get back to that idea, you are offering a service to the world. I know so many older people who have found new ways to be of service, to offer their service. And I write about them in this book too. I write about people who have found ways to either to keep their job even to their older years. That's what I hope to do, to keep writing books. That's what I want to do if I can. And I know I interviewed a man who was a lawyer who stopped being a lawyer, but then used his skills to help young musicians develop their careers. And he found that incredibly satisfying. So I think there are ways to offer service to the world and wisdom to the world. We certainly need to educate our politicians. Our politicians need a great deal of education. They appear not to have had much education, a sense of community and values that are not just selfish, that are not just self-serving. So that all takes education and character as well as mind. And I think older people have a chance to help younger people have that education.
Hmm. Thank you so much. I appreciate very much what you just shared and really being of service and sharing your life experience and the wisdom you kind of collected during your life and, yeah, bringing it into service. So, and Thomas, we are kind of almost at the end of our time together, and I just want to give you the opportunity, if there is anything left where you think it's really important to share with our audience, because the people which are watching this summit are really interested in evolving into their full expression, into their full potential, and really also supporting each other and really coming together as a global human family in that.
Yes, there's so many things, other things that we could talk about. But one thing that is helps me a great deal is something I learned from my friend Hillman through my friendship with him, and that is, and also through his writing, that when it comes to the difficulties we have in our life, especially our personal emotional problems like depression or jealousies or envy or sadness, frustration, he always said that it's important to go with the symptom, that is, to go into the symptom rather than against it. I use this in my practice all the time, this idea. And what it means is that if you are feeling sad, or if you're with a friend who is feeling sad, it's not probably such a great idea just to try to cheer that person up or cheer yourself up. That the sadness is there doing something for you. And so the thing to do is to deepen whatever it is that is bothering you. And when you're talking to people who are complaining or telling you that there's one problem or another, you can do the same thing. Rather than just try to cheer them up and go into some opposite place that looks better to you, you could instead stay with them and stay with their feeling, their emotion, and help them by encouraging them maybe in some ways to tell you the story of what they're going through. The many stories maybe, and some of the root stories that go way back into family and so on. So there are ways that you can be with yourself and with the world around you that can be very useful and helpful, especially in these days when we have so many emotional extremes and problems and so much negativity. The thing to do, I think, is always to go further into that, those issues. In an ordinary conversation, you know, you can stop yourself when you just try to get people to switch over to a much more positive point of view. I don't mean to be negative about it, certainly not to develop a negative attitude. It's just the opposite, really. It's just that you can be empathic with what is going on and get further with it if you work that way. And actually, that brings us closer to each other, because if all we're doing is trying to cheer each other on, what we're doing is, well, we're not doing anything about the issues. You know, we are just, we're in this lopsided situation where we go from feeling bad to trying to feel good, feeling bad, trying to feel good. It's not the way to do it. The thing to do would be all of us to realize that life is full of tragedy and joy. It's all comedy and tragedy. And keep our sense of the comic even as we go deeply into the tragic.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for reminding us to this very important kind of inner attitudes and how we can be with difficulty. I really appreciate that, Thomas. I thank you so much for taking this time, being with us, sharing your experiences, your wisdom, and I will also provide the link to your website, so where people can find all the books and material and events you offer. Is there anything else you want to make our audience aware of? And just keep in mind that the summit will take place in autumn of this year.
Well, the only other thing I might add to that, I think my website will have everything that's required, but I am experimenting now. I do travel. I still travel a bit and would love to see people. And I get to Europe, and I will be in Zurich in May, and with my wife, both of us, you know, speaking there. And so I look forward to meeting people in different parts of the world. And I'm always going to Ireland and England. But the United States here in New England is also a good place to come and see me. And I'm going to begin an online course of my own where the whole of my work I want to try to present to people who want to go into it more deeply. So they might look for that too.
Thank you. Wonderful. I will also keep our audience be informed also in the future. So if you have anything relevant you want to share, just let me know. And also in the future, I can spread it. And I thank you, Thomas, for taking your time and sharing your wisdom with us. And I also want to thank you in the audience, watching this video, listening to the audio, that you really kind of stayed with us, opened up, and maybe be touched and inspired and get some, yeah, insights in the deep and in the light, and that you might maybe take also this notion of humor and this not taking yourself too serious, open up to your ageless part and the angel, as Thomas mentioned. So I felt the conversation really very rich, and I guess everyone can take some little gifts away with it.
Thank you, Maria. It's wonderful to speak to you.
Thank you.